available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website, the talking newspaper for Coventry. This is Outlook.
Hello and welcome from me, Nigel Hewin, to this week's edition of Outlook, being recorded on Wednesday the 24th of September 2025. And in this edition, Elaine is going to find out some wartime memories from Napton-on-the-Hill. We're going to start a series, a series of Homage to Fromage. It's all about cheeses, French and English. Living in the Quack House, well, that's some lady who's got a passion for birds. And, of course, Bill's going to complete his story about full steam ahead steam engines. We're going to have another additional Dictionary Corner, excuse me, put my teeth back in, from Margaret. Dave and Graham are going to Alveston Hall for a tribute band of Rod Stewart. If you like Rod Stewart, you'll hear some of that later. But first, as ever, oh, I beg your pardon, I should say also, there is going to be sport, your news from the centre here, and, of course, your post bag. But first, as ever, local news with Elaine and myself.
News.
Zara Sultana, MP for Coventry South, hit out at Jeremy Corbyn and other founding party members for disregarding women's views as part of the founding of their new left-wing party. The ex-Labour MP claims an agreement which put her and Corbyn in charge of the group, currently using the temporary name Your Party, has been overlooked, with other founding members, men, taking a leading role in her stead. The comments come after a back and forth between Ms. Sultana and other founding members, starting last Thursday when your party supporters were offered £55 memberships via email. But Corbyn took to social media to brand this email unauthorised, with legal advice being sought. The party has referred it to the Information Commissioner's Office. But Ms. Sultana claims the email was sent in line with the roadmap previously laid out by the party. In response to the membership email, Corbyn's statement telling people to ignore Sultana was signed off by other founders of the party. Ms. Sultana responded late on Thursday saying, "My sole motivation has been to safeguard the grassroots involvement that is essential to building this party. Unfortunately, I have been subjected to what can only be described as a sexist boys' club. I have been treated appallingly and excluded completely. They have refused to allow any other women with voting rights on the working group, blocking the gender-balanced committee that both Jeremy and I signed up to." The party said the developments were a blow for everyone who has put their hope in a real alternative, and that Ms. Sultana has not been excluded from any discussions. It's been a turbulent beginning for the party. The pair struggled to land on the right name for the party, with Corbyn wanting it called Your Party, something she didn't agree with. The name is in place as a temporary moniker until a new one is decided by members. Ms. Sultana has also reportedly clashed with Independent MP for Blackburn, Mr. Hussein, over their different views on trans rights. The party had begun to build momentum with more than 750,000 supporters signed up since its launch earlier this year. But opponents on Thursday also highlighted a company's house listing that showed Mr. Corbyn ceased to be a person with significant control of Your Party UK Limited on September the 15th. It is understood that this is because of Corbyn falling below the threshold as other independent MPs became directors.
Work has begun on major road safety improvements in Coventry after a young boy was tragically killed. Several changes are being implemented on Radford Road and Lawrence Saunders Road. A number of new safety initiatives are being introduced as part of a wider project to tackle dangerous driving. Part of Radford Road will be subjected to a 20-mile-per-hour speed limit after the death of 12-year-old Keaton Slater in June last year. In the years since the tragedy, his family have been pushing for stronger road safety measures in Radford. Coventry City Council previously confirmed that a new crossing and pedestrian island are being installed on nearby Lawrence Saunders Road. Councillor Patricia Heatherton said the footway will also be extended at the junction with Poole Road to reduce speeding. Speed bumps are also being installed on Radford Road. Other improvements being made are improved crossings and clearer road markings. A spokesman for Coventry Council said, "We will also be extending sections of pavement, so where people do have to cross, the road will be narrower, which has the advantage of slowing down traffic and improving visibility for the person crossing." Councillor Heatherton, Cabinet Member for City Services, said, "Changes are being introduced in response to local concerns and to make the area safer for pedestrians and drivers. We want to make roads as safe as possible, and we will continue working with the community as this scheme progresses."
The culprits behind the Jaguar Land Rover cyber attack have been unmasked. The incident has shut down the company's sites in Solihull and Wolverhampton, having a devastating impact on manufacturing and sales operations since it happened over 2 weeks ago. And the ransomware group responsible for the ongoing disruption to the company's production has declared its intentions to halt operations. In a statement on its now defunct Telegram channel, Scattered Lapus Hunters announced it would cease activity, stating, "Silence will now be our strength." The name is a collective of English-speaking hackers, a combination of the names of the hacking groups Scattered Spider, Lapsus and Shiny Hunters. Scattered Spider, a loose assembly of relatively young hackers, was implicated in the Co-op, Harrods and M&S attacks earlier this year. You may see our name in new data breach disclosure reports from the tens of others multi-billion dollar companies that have yet to disclose a breach, as well as some government agencies, including highly secured ones. "But that does not mean we are still active," read their farewell message. They and many others have decided to go dark. They said that having fulfilled their objectives, it was now time to say goodbye. The message also referenced the gang members who have been targeted and apprehended by law enforcement, extending our regrets to their relatives and apologising for their sacrifice. "Any state needs its scapegoat," the message went on. "Those carefully selected targets are the last collateral victims of our war on power, and the use of our skills to humiliate those who have humiliated and predate those who have been predated." A leading automotive expert said the ongoing cyber attack crisis engulfing Jaguar Land Rover and its suppliers has cost the car-making giant over £1 billion.
Figures released as part of Coventry City Council's annual report into adult social care show that £145 million was spent in the 12 months to April, an increase of nearly £6 million from the previous year. In his report, Pete Fahey, the Council's Director of Adult Services, explained that the figures highlighted the work being done to improve the lives of vulnerable people. It also kept tabs on how well the service was performing. Speaking at a Health and Social Care Security Board meeting last week, he said, "This is such a big area of our business, impacting on so many people in the city, and with such a huge spend, the more oversight we have of our activity, the better. The annual report gives you a flavour of what we do and the impact of that." The money is immense, £145 million gross spend, with a £3 million a week gives us all, give or take, give or take on adult social services care. Of this, $115 million is spent on people, providing direct support to communities. The biggest area of spend is home care, which is £44 million, and we are quite glad that that's the case because we prefer people to be at home. Councillor Sai Agbula asked why there had been an increase in overall spending on adult social services, which prompts Mr. Fahiz to say, "Our spend has gone up largely as a result of factors like the national living wage increases, which has a direct impact on the price we pay for care. Secondly, it's the cost of care for new cases, which is generally more expensive. People are living longer with more complex conditions." He added that in terms of spend, Coventry City Council was on a par with many others, but added there was a point about 5 years ago when we were quite a bit below average. It became an issue because we were struggling to recruit, but we are now much more in line and we are paying a little bit more. He added, "As elected members, you have better links with communities in your areas than we have. We are not known in the community in the same way as you are, and I'd ask members to be part of our voice in reaching and communicating with those groups which can then help us adapt our services and develop."
A Coventry business caught employing illegal workers has been fined £40,000. Shiny Five Star Car Wash Limited in Bell Green was penalised by the Home Office. Officials regularly name and shame companies that have been employing staff with no right to work in the UK. Such illegal working has been identified as a key factor in attracting undocumented migrants to Britain. It has prompted the Home Office to hike fines to £45,000 per worker and carry out more raids across Coventry and the West Midlands. More than 300 UK businesses found employing workers illegally were fined between December 24 and March 2025. Shiny Five Star Car Wash Limited on Henley Road in Bell Green was raided in August 2024, and an Iraqi man found working illegally was arrested. Bosses were subsequently fined the £40,000. Other West Midlands businesses, including takeaways, beauty salons and barber shops, have also been penalised. But the UK company that received the highest fine of £320,000 was OKE Development Limited in Herefordshire. A spokesman for the Home Office said, "Illegal working undermines honest employers and undercuts local wages. It is against the law to work in the UK when you have no right to be here. We are clamping down on employers who do this up and down the country." In a warning to those employing illegal workers, they said, "You can be sent to jail for 5 years and have to pay an unlimited fine if you are found guilty of employing someone who you knew or had reasonable cause to believe did not have the right to work in the UK."
Police action has seen officers recover several stolen vehicles across Coventry. In a successful few days, police found one car in a retail park and returned it to its rightful owner, and used good old-fashioned police work in pulling over a driver in a car with dodgy licence plates. A spokesman for Coventry Police said, "In the northwest of the city, officers located two vehicles discovered to be stolen and have been recovered pending further investigation to find the owners. In the St Michael's area, PCSO Parker found a stolen vehicle in a retail park. The vehicle has now been recovered and will be reunited with the relieved owner." But it doesn't end there, the spokesman added. A few days ago, the city centre team responded to a report of an abandoned vehicle. After further checks, the vehicle was found to have no road tax since April, so was seized.
Hot on the tail of thieves, response officers stopped a vehicle suspected to have cloned plates. It was later discovered that the vehicle was stolen from the city centre and will now be sent to forensics for further examination.
Transport delays, slow walkers and buffering internet pages have been ranked among the most annoying everyday delays in a new Impatient Nation study. A poll of 3,000 adults uncovered that a fifth, the equivalent to 10.7 million Brits, consider themselves impatient. This comes as almost 20% blame social media for their lack of patience, with a further 40% citing advancement of technology. The research commissioned by Sky Broadband revealed that just over a quarter of Brits will only wait for a maximum of 3 minutes when faced with a delay of any kind. When it comes to waiting for something to load online, almost a third admit to not being able to wait a single minute before losing their patience, and 12 minutes is the average amount of time people are willing to wait for public transport delays. Having already improved the nation's second biggest frustration, slow internet, Sky Broadband is now helping speed up other areas of daily life. As part of a new trial in Leeds and Glasgow, special fast lanes have been introduced on busy pedestrian streets, which is favourable for the 44% of people who want to separate the strollers from the striders. The top 10 things that frustrate us. Number 1. Transport delays. Plane, train and bus. 42% of us. Number 2. Slow or buffering internet. 41%. Slow or bad drivers. 37%. Slow service in any service capacity. 34%. Slow walkers, 33%. Queuing, 33%. Pedestrian traffic, for example, people taking up the whole path or someone stopping in the middle of a path, 29%. Waiting for or missing a delivery, 28%. Film or TV show buffering partway through, 25%. And in the 10th place, waiting for something to download or update, just 25%.
New restoration work has taken place at Coventry's special Victorian town garden. Stony Road Allotments is one of only four remaining detached Victorian town gardens that are listed on Historic England's Register of Parks and Gardens of Special Historic Interest. Now, three 19th century summer houses on the site have been repaired and renovated. The Grade 2 listed summer houses in Stony Stanton Allotments in Charlesmoor were in disrepair. The summer houses are the last remaining plots of the park gardens that were established over 200 years ago. They now have new windows and doors, replacement roofs, and the walls have been reconstructed with lime mortar and original bricks. Historic England provided a £250,000 grant to help with the restoration of the buildings, and both Railway Heritage Trust and Network Rail also provided support. Councillor Naeem Akhtar, a cabinet member with responsibility for heritage at Coventry Council, said, "I've already visited the summer houses and saw the careful repair work. The buildings were in a poor state, and that's why it is so satisfying to see the work on the restoration of the building structures completed. It's been a fascinating project, and it highlights the importance of the wide range of heritage buildings in the city." The site is still used as allotments and subtenanted by the Stony Road Gardens Association, and the summer houses can also be visited by the public.
A retired Coventry couple's vintage pram collection, spanning back to the 19th century, is expected to raise £10,000 at auction. Brian and Shirley Bromage devoted more than five decades to building their treasure trove of 50 historical pushchairs. Their oldest model dates from 1878, while another boasts Art Deco decoration from 1930s France. The pair's cherished pram is a silver cross, the very model used by successive generations of royals, including King Charles and Princess Charlotte. The duo are now parting with their remarkable collection, which they have housed in a substantial shed in their Coventry home. Great-grandmother Shirley, who is 87, reveals she became enchanted with prams during childhood. She said, "I don't know what it was about them, but if a relative or anyone in the village had one, I was just fascinated." Their collection features numerous examples originating from the golden era of the British pram in the 50s and 60s. It includes models by the premier manufacturers, including Marmet, Manton and Osnath. Shirley bought her initial pram, a navy blue silver cross, for her son Martin in 1960. It cost £36, and I remember my mother telling me it would be bad luck to buy it too early, but I just couldn't wait to push it up and down the hall. It marked the beginning of an extensive collection, with each pram tenderly and painstakingly restored to its former glory. Husband Brian, also 87, who was employed by tractor manufacturer Massey Ferguson, was an automobile restorer. He said, "I had my cars, and Shirley wanted her own thing, which soon became my thing. I was happy to help. The craftsmanship of the prams, especially the early ones, is tremendous. Now, with six grandchildren and seven great-grandchildren, the couple are downsizing to make room for their family." Brian said, "We have taken part in pram pushes around the UK, but now it's time to sell the collection. It's a sad decision, but we have only ever been the pram's caretakers, and it's time to pass them on to new owners." The Silver Cross models embody timeless British luxury and royal heritage. It is a magical opportunity to purchase a vintage pram in wonderful condition to carry your own little ones, or as a fabulous showpiece to store dolls and teddy bears. The collection will go under the hammer at Hanson's Derbyshire Sale Room on the 28th of September.
Outlook News.
And that brings you the news from Elaine and myself for this week. Slightly shorter, but there you are. It's what news does. Sometimes, some weeks it's busy, some weeks it's not. Announcements? Only one, actually. The usual one. You guess what it is? Yes, sunrise, which is now at 6.50. And sunset in the evening, 6.52. Even these nice bright days this week. And now it is time to introduce Chris.
Hello listeners, happy whatever day you're listening to this recording on. So I'm going to do something a little bit different this week because I have, I was about to say a prisoner then, but that sounds really bad, like, my God, the police called. So I have in my office my friend and volunteer Estelle. So I'm going to let Estelle do the notices this week because, because why not?
This is very exciting. This is a voice you will not have heard on the talking newspaper before. So, hello. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
There are two lovely announcements. The one that is very exciting is that the centre, the Coventry Vision Hub, is getting a new bus.
Yippee!
And that will be delivered in January of 2026. It's got something to do with licensing or... What did you say it was?
It's something to do with... I think Carl wants the latest plate possible, I presume, because insurance and probably because we're going to have it for the next 25 years, so...
Yeah, makes sense to me.
Yeah.
And there's some cool thing about it being made and windows being inserted.
Yeah. So you just buy... The thing you buy or they deliver from wherever is just... like a removals van. So it's got doors in the front, and then the back is just a big box, and they have to cut holes in it for the windows and the side door and all that kind of thing.
That's really cool.
Yeah, I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah, neither did I.
No.
The other very cool announcement, which will happen before the bus, which is exciting, is an upcoming theatre trip. Mm-hmm. Which will happen on the 17th of October, that is a Friday, to see The Cursed House.
Yes, which is a psychological thriller, I'm told.
Ooh, that's very exciting. Mm. Where is that, Chris?
So that is at the Alsley Village Hall, and it's run by a new drama group, the name of which I've just forgotten.
Oh, well, that's all right.
Why don't you do the rest of it? Oh, for God's sake. This is live! It's called the Saints Drama Group, yay!
Right. And that is, there is a plan to do a touch tour, as far as I know.
Yep, we're trying to start on the touch tour.
Yeah, so that's very exciting. That's all new things. The cost to go to this lovely theatre production is £8 if you plan to take the bus. And, yeah, Hugh is debating whether or not fish and chips will be involved, which sounds like a great idea to me, Hugh.
Well, they usually do fish and chips, so yeah, if they don't do fish and chips, I'd riot if I was you lot. That's what I'd do. Absolute riot.
Yep. Riots sound fun to me.
Yeah. So yeah, theatre trip, and huge big thanks to Jo. She worked tirelessly to get this minibus. So the minibus, as I think it's costing, I want to say like 56,000. It's a shed load of money. And Joe has scraped that all together from various grants things. Yeah. It's been a couple of years in the making. There's been private donations going into it. There's been funding and things, and yeah, a lot of hard work. Joe and Carl drove off to Stoke-on-Trent, I think, to look at it and get it all specced out. So yeah, a lot of work went into it. So thank you very much, Joe.
Yeah, and you guys will get a new bus out of it.
Oh yeah. Which would be nice, because the current ones are very old, and there's all these things like, if you open the door and then go around a corner, then you close the door, it goes around a corner, it opens, or it thinks it's open. There's lots of little things with these buses. There was loads of really, if you're interested in the technical side of it, anybody, ask Carl, because there was all sorts of things about what stairs to use so they didn't weaken the chassis, because that's what caused the weird door opening on the old bus. There's all sorts of things which I didn't even realise were a consideration. So the other thing we're here to talk about is the Carve Co exhibition the other week. So anybody who's been around me in the last few months will have heard me bang on about this company, Carve Co, Warwick-based company, who have been turning two-dimensional photographs into 3D tactile art. You may well have touched the picture of Claire and me at our wedding, because that's been on my desk, although somebody's nabbed that. I'm going on an absolute witch hunt to get that back. So Estelle and I and a few others went to London on the 15th of September, and we touched all the art.
Yeah.
The focal point of which was the mural wall, which had some rather special photos on it, didn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Including ones of us.
Of us, yeah. Yeah.
So tell us about your photo.
So I am, for those who don't know me, I am South African, and I had an amazing experience as a child, and I really wanted to recreate that experience. And so I took my partner to like a sanctuary kind of thing, where they do really cool things. They are very passionate about predator protection, and they've done artificial insemination with lions and cheetahs and I think hyenas as well. And like, just a very, very cool place from that perspective. But some of the things that they do are they let you hold lion cubs, and they let you walk with fully grown lions with protections in place. I'm not stumbling about in the 30 degree sun wearing a suit of armor to protect myself. But I did one of these walks, and one of the photos that I had taken on this walk was of me standing in front of a tree with a fully grown lion in the branches of the tree, which is the picture I sent to Brad from Carve Co. And this was represented in 3D form, and it was very, very cool. I did not know how close the lion was to me, which explains why everyone, when they saw it, kind of freaked out a little bit.
It does look very close, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Like, just over your
shoulder. Just over my left shoulder, yeah. What else was cool?
What else was cool? Well, the bit I thought was really cool was for the first time ever, a human being got to touch their own shadow.
Yeah, that was also me, by the way. Mm-hmm. and what's really, really interesting is like the way that I understand these things are kind of relieved onto the artwork is that it measures how pronounced, how close the focal point is to the camera lens. And so things that are closer are kind of more pronounced, and things that are further away are less pronounced, or, you know, that are more faded. And so because the shadow is kind of stretching out behind me, it's quite a lot less pronounced than not only my body, but also like the ground behind me and the tree. And so everything else is so pronounced, and there's just this tiny sliver that is very, very faded, and that is my shadow.
And it was indented, wasn't it, rather than extruded, which was
yes,
it was interesting.
Yeah,
it's fascinating.
Yeah, very cool people on that mural. Yep. Some names you will know.
Yeah, who'd we got?
Zoe and Steve.
That's right.
Chris and Claire. Both of those were wedding pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Cameron and Michaela and baby Lara, which was adorable.
Yes, it was.
That was really, really cute. I think that's everyone from Coventry.
If you follow like the internet, there was a few names you might recognise. There was Lucy
Edwards.
That's the one. One of her wedding photos. Lots of wedding photos.
Yes, lots.
Ellie Walwork, who's a blind actor. Is she famous? That feels a bit generous.
Yes, I would say she's.
Yeah, she's certainly known for, isn't she?
Yes, yes.
Her performances in Call the Midwife and Doctor Who.
Yeah. There was Robin Hughes.
Oh, yeah.
She's a ballerina from the US. She sent in a photo and also came to look at it.
Yes.
Yeah, so travelled all the way from the US to come and see her 3D photo, which is really, really cool.
And that's really interesting, because people talk about tutus, don't they, quite a lot, and I have no idea what one is. And people also talk about, like, you know, so-and-so looks like a dancer. And again, yeah, it's always been abstract. But actually, I can sort of see what they mean. Like, she felt like a dancer,
yes,
didn't she? Her 100%. Body was just tiny, like,
yeah,
really willowy limbs.
Yeah.
And I think
super graceful.
Yeah. And I think in the photo, one of her legs was up. And
yes, down, it was, like, yeah, behind her, yeah.
But, yeah, in a position I'm not sure my leg would go to, and certainly wouldn't look, yeah, that elegant doing it.
Oh, it was lovely.
So, yeah, it was wicked.
Yeah, the Chris Fisher.
Oh, yeah, Chris Fisher. So he's the Britain's blind wood turner. I think he's the only blind person to be an accredited, qualified,
yes,
whatever,
qualified
wood turner.
Yeah.
So the photo he had was of his dad, which was taken a long time ago. And he remembers the photo being taken because he could see then, but he's not been able to see it for
as long
very
as he's
long.
Been blind.
Yes. So for him, that was a really big,
yeah,
experience.
Yeah. There were really cool things that you wouldn't usually, you know, be aware of, like Edinburgh Castle.
Yes,
that was cool. And Stonehenge, that was really fascinating. And then there were like famous people as well. There was the Beatles and David Attenborough. There was a David Bowie album cover.
Jane Austen,
yeah. William Shakespeare had a really crooked nose, by the way.
Yeah.
It's almost poking him in the right eye. It's really funny.
Winston Churchill doing the Victory V's.
Yeah. Mo Farah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With very pronounced teeth.
Yeah, he's beaming.
He is. He's
genuinely
a pretty happy boy.
Yeah.
I mean, I just won the 10,000 metres, so I think I'd be pretty chipper as well.
Honestly, it was so incredibly cool and vaguely emotional as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's just having the experience of being able to not only see yourself, but see other things, other people, things that are, you know, famous and world-renowned, like David Attenborough.
And Stonehenge.
You
get to touch that.
The Angel of the North.
Oh, yeah.
You know, things like that that are just so incredibly famous.
Yeah.
And you have access to it, all of that. But it's just amazing.
And that's a technology now that's available to anybody who can pay the bill, really. So, unfortunately, it's not a piece of software that you can use as a blind person. I'd like it to be, and actually, Carco would like it to be, but it's not there. So, watch this space, I suppose. But certainly, art exhibitions can use it. And indeed, some of the pictures the reliefs from the exhibition they're hoping to have exhibited at the Herbert Art Gallery for a while. So that'll be.
I heard they were potentially looking at selling others.
Good.
Yeah. So there will be a mixture of like them being exhibited and them being potentially sold, and it's just it's genuinely such a lovely thing that they're doing. And I think it would have so much meaning, not only for people who've lost their vision and now have access to that kind of visual representation again, but also for people who have never seen anything, you know, that would be both of us. And I just, it's incredibly special.
So yeah, thank you very much for listening. I hope you're all having a wonderful week and continue to have a wonderful week. And I will speak to you whenever Hugh's out of the building again. Have a good week. Bye-bye.
And now it's time for Sarah's sports report.
Well, hello there, lovely, lovely listeners. And I hope you're okay in the coldest snap that we're having at the moment. Although, as I'm recording this, I have got the most wonderful sun peeking through my window. Now, as usual, I'm going to start off with football before mentioning a bit about F1, then tennis, then athletics, before I build up to a massive crescendo with the Rugby World Cup. Oh yeah, and also golf. Right. On Saturday, Coventry headed up, or could it be down or along? I'm not very sure with my geography. The M69 to play Leicester. Now there's a lot of, well, I use the word hatred, but it's hatred in banter and comments. It's not hatred as in knuckle duster fights between Leicester and Coventry. Now imagine the picture. They always wear blue, and as they play at home, they get first cut of the colours they play in. So we wore our away strip, which is politely called hot coral. Very quite dark, very vibrant pink. Well, it was a fantastic first half. I couldn't move away from the radio. But despite both sides really battling and going for it, at half time, it was 0-0. Now, all things changed in the second half of the second half, when I'm afraid Leicester were really in the ascendancy. In fact, at one stage, we had 9 of our players defending. Oh, how much longer could this carry on? Well, it fortunately carried on until the end, with the score at full time, 0-0. Now, as neither side had won, the man of the match was allowed to be chosen from either side. And I'm not surprised to hear, or actually see, because I watched it, that it was presented to our goalie, Carl Rushford. You know, the new guy who's on loan from Brighton. He had a blinding second half, keeping out so many goals. So well done, Carl. The next match is next Saturday, that's the 27th, and it's at the CBS, the Coventry Building Society Arena, and it's another local derby, but this time it's against the Blues, another team in blue, Birmingham. Yeah, Birmingham were promoted this year after a season down in League One. But they're doing quite well, so it should be a good match, or certainly a tight match. Now, just following up on something I mentioned last week, Racing Club Warwick, midweek, replayed their match to qualify for the third qualifying round of the FA Cup. but sadly they lost. Unlike yesterday, Rugby Town, who won and are so into that third qualifying round. So if they win that, they'll then be up against not the big boys, but the little big boys, those being the clubs of Division 1 and 2. Today has been the F1 from Azerbaijan. Well, it was kind of business as usual with the winner, Max Verstappen. But with the number 2 Brit, George Russell, in second place, followed by Carlos Sainz, who brings Williams, his team, their first podium finish of the season. How nice to hear a different name on that podium. The week just gone in tennis has seen the Billie Jean King Cup, the women's equivalent of the Davis Cup. And we were ably represented by Katie Bolter and Sunny Cartel, and a few others, but we didn't need them to play. I have to say I was not impressed to hear that Emma Raducanu had withdrawn to concentrate on her personal development with her new coach. Well, in the first round, well, the quarterfinals, we thumped Japan 2-0, meaning there was no need for our doubles players to step up to the mark. But unfortunately, in the semi-finals, we faced the United States, who returned the compliment, thumping us 2-0. But it has to be said, they were top-ranked American players, you know, ranked so much higher than either Katie or Sonny. So they turned up. Now, the week just gone has seen the World Athletics Championships. And I told you last week how at that time we had no gold, no silver and no bronze. Well, things did improve, although I have to say I felt so sorry for Molly Cowdery, our women's pole vaulter, who was tipped to get a medal and she had to leave the track, not just in tears, but in a wheelchair after rupturing ligaments in her takeoff angle. Well, Molly, we are now in the close season, so you take care and come back. We got the Commonwealth Games next year. Ooh, yes. So, Wednesday saw our first medal. It was the men's 1500 metres and Josh Kerr was strongly tipped to retain his title. But it wasn't Josh who medalled. It was Jake Whiteman, the son of the stadium commentator. He got silver and was pipped to gold by 1/200th of a second. But as he said to him, after the year he's had with injuries, that was like a gold medal. On Friday, we welcomed a relatively new name to our medal hall. Well, I'd never heard of her, actually. Amy Hunt. Amy won another silver, but this time in the women's 200 metres. Apparently, as a junior athlete, she had been world champion before deciding to not pursue full-time athletics, but to train part-time and continue her academic studies. But not just any academic studies, she's a Cambridge graduate. Oh well, Amy, both clever and fast. On Saturday, we have the last day of the women's heptathlon. You know, that event for masochists, where they compete in 7 different sports over 2 days, involving both running and throwing and jumping to get 1 medal, well, 3 medals, the gold, the silver and the bronze. Now, going into the last event, the women's 800 metres, our main Brit, Katarina Johnson-Thompson, was in 4th place. And she knew she had to beat the woman who at that stage was in 3rd, Karen Brooks, by 6 seconds in order to snatch the bronze. Well, I'm afraid she could only muster 5.9, and there was a lot of radio silence and delays as the result came up on the screen. And in the end, they shared the bronze medal. Now, just to put that in context, 7 different events where literally 0.1 of a second equals a point in the 800 metres, and 1 inch in high jump is several points. Over 7,500 points, and they couldn't be separated. So I think it's a well-deserved joint bronze. So on Sunday, we thought, well, the commentators were bigging Sunday up. We've got our best chance of a gold now. We've got Keely Hodgkinson running. Oh, yeah, and also her teammate, both trained by Jenny Meadows, Georgia Hunter-Bell. But as usual, it did not go to plan. They both came in behind the Kenyan winner, but Georgia in silver with Keely in bronze. So well done, ladies. But I was really pleased personally for Georgia, because she has so long been in the shadow of Keely. So what was our overall total? Well, we finished off with still no golds, but 3 silvers and 2 bronze. And so now we move on to rugby union. Well, it was the semi-final of the World Cup between France and England. And to listen to the commentators before the match, you'd have thought all England had to do was come out the changing room with the kit on to be gift-wrapped a place in the final. Well, France had very different ideas to that, it has to be said. Now, it started very well, because within 4 minutes, England had scored a try and converted it. So it was 0-7. But then, wouldn't you just know it, France also scored a try but couldn't convert. So England still had a narrow lead, 5-7. But then it got really frenetic, and to be honest, France was so much on top. I mean, even the commentators were making remarks like, far too many England mistakes. It didn't sound good. In fact, France did have 2 tries disallowed by the TMO for marginal infringements. So I think that England were really glad to still be at 5-7 going in at half time. Now, the second half began just as frenetically as the first had finished, and eventually England scored another try and converted it, 5-14. But then, wouldn't you just know it, as in the first half, France said, anything you can do, and they also scored a try and this time converted it, 12-14. But then local lass from Bristol, because that was where the match was being played, scored another try, which absolutely made the crowd go ecstatic, and converted 12 points to 21. Now, I have to say, the fourth English try was absolutely superb, but it was scored by the world's leading player, Ellie Kildon. She just picked that ball up out of the scrum or whatever, where it was on the ground, surrounded by players, and ran like a bat out of hell to have enough time to carefully position it between the goal posts to make a conversion really easy, 12 points to 28. But then France put on, well, I won't say a comeback, but with 7 minutes to go, they scored another try, but yet again couldn't convert, 17-28. And like us, when in the dying embers of the match, we scored and converted, and that was how it finished, 17 points to 35. Well, if you can stand episode 2, England play Canada in the final next Saturday, 27th, at 4 p.m. I don't know that my nerves will stand it. Canada did put out, actually, in New Zealand, the reigning world champions. I mean, I wasn't sure if it was just me being really stressed and worried about how this match was going, but I phoned a friend and she could only sum it up as one thing. Oh, ecky thump. Now, just one very quick final comment about golf before I finish and leave you in peace. Don't forget, it's the Ryder Cup beginning on Friday, Saturday and Sunday, between the top European and the 12 top American players. They play first day a mixture of doubles and foursomes, and on the final day, the Sunday, it's singles. So I wonder what I will have to talk about next week. Anyway, I better go because otherwise I'll be cut off because I'm overrunning. Okay, bye. Have a great week.
That's a summary of sports for the last week. But of course, there's still plenty going on.
This is Postback. Join in the discussion.
Hello there and welcome to your postbag. I'd just like to begin, in case you've heard anything on the radio, by telling you that on Sunday the 14th of September at the Belgrade Theatre, multi-millionaire, pop mogul Pete Waterman presented me with the BBC CWR Make a Difference Award in the Great Neighbour category for my voluntary work in helping visually impaired people. He was the judge of that category. And having sort of met him at the Belgrade on that day, he remembered that I'd interviewed him on several occasions in the past. I was nominated by Cheryl Burton, the daughter of late listener Gwen Edge, and I said in the interview that I tried to help visually impaired people share information to help each other, which I'm trying to do here in your postbag. But this week is a bit light, but we do have Graham to tell you what he thinks about the streetlights going back on at night and the suggested plans to move the Coventry Road Transport Museum to the former IKEA building.
Well, I've just been hearing in Outlook News that the council are considering moving the Transport Museum out of the city centre. No decisions have been taken yet, as they tell us. But the fact that it's being discussed, well, as they say, there's no smoke without fire. It would be a terrible thing to happen. I mean, what we got left in the city centre now, apart from Cathedral? A lot of the shops closed. Well, there weren't that many left. Big names, anyway. A lot of the others are closed. And it really would be tragic if the Transport Museum moved out. There'd be nothing there to attract tourists. So I hope that's knocked on the head soon. On the other hand, as I'm sure Pete Smith will be pleased to hear, they are talking about switching the street lights on at night. How they can afford to do that, having that the LED replacement scheme will not be completed for another year or so, I don't know. But it just shows they can find money to do these things if they really want to.
Thank you, Graham. Talking about transport, Robert Franklin gave a really helpful talk at the Monday Club about how he goes on holiday, mainly to Tynmouth by rail on his own with the help of Journeycare. They are on 08000 15813, so that's 08000 15813. And Robert says, one of the things I do before going to Tynmouth is to write a list of what I'm going to put in my case. There's always something I'm likely to forget. Robert became partially sighted at the age of 2, followed by macular degeneration and glaucoma. He tells you what gave him the confidence to travel to his favourite destination for a holiday.
I never thought that I would end up travelling to Tynmouth on my own. I've never had confidence before. I have Journeycare, which you have to book 24 hours before you go. And it's useful if you've, you know, when you've got a case.
Robert stops at the Seaway Guesthouse, who are on 01626 879024. And he uses Dawlish Community Transport, who are on 01626 8888. Robert saves money by getting a disabled person's rail card, and they are on 0345 605525. If you forget any of these numbers, ask me. Thank you, Robert. If you're changing a Birmingham New Street, they have a Journeycare waiting room where, after telling them who you are, having let them know beforehand, and details of your rail journey, where you're going to change out and things like this, and your destination, they will let you know when the train arrives and take you and your luggage to the right platform and help you on the train. And now Doreen Hilton replies to Edwina, who was asking what your favourite smells are.
It's Doreen Hilton speaking again. Last Friday I heard Edwina. Edwina, I thank you very, very much for what you were saying, and it was a very, very good subject. Now, while I say the subject, you spoke about listening to things and also smelling. Now, yes, I do have certain things for smelling, but Doreen is a person that's had her haddy noise done from a young baby of 8 months old. That's a part of my disability. And when you've had something done like that, you've got to be very, very careful with smelling. It's not everybody that's had it done. I'd say most people who have had it done, like myself, because there's various smells which you get really, really strong. And if they get really, really strong, that can hit your sinuses in your nose. And also, once it goes from your sinuses, it goes to your eyes. Now, as for being blind as well, it could affect it too, as though I have got a little bit of sight. And when it affects it, you can get a really, really nasty headache with a migraine. But all the same, I think it was lovely what you said. But I will give my smells. And Doreen here, I do like the smell of when we're travelling in the countryside. We're at Licky Grange School, where I was at. I believe it was all countryside. And when we used to go for a nature walk, especially in the wind, you could smell all the lovely greenery from the grass fields and the trees. And also in the bluebell woods where we used to go. I think that's my way of smelling on that side.
Thank you very much, Doreen. More from Doreen next week about sounds. Now we have some sad news from Graham Whale.
It has just come to my notice that Margaret Hobley has passed away. I doubt whether many people would remember Margaret now. She is a past secretary and organiser for the Coventry Reader Service for the Blind and Partially Sighted. And she's passed away. She must have been in her 90s. I don't know how old she was, to be honest. I know the funeral is on the 29th of September, but I don't know the details. But I believe it has been printed in the Telegraph, so if anybody's interested, they can search it out. But I thought there might be somebody listening who remembers her, so I thought I'd mention it.
Thank you, Graham. The Coventry Reader Service for the Blind is a very helpful service where volunteer readers that have been checked out come to your house and read letters, documents, etc. in strict confidence, and magazines, etc. to you. Ask myself or Graham if you're interested, and we'll give you the phone number. And to end this week's postbag on a happy note, Elizabeth says that she had a lovely day out on a boat trip on the River Trent, with a chicken dinner included. It was organised by Dunwoods, who have an office in Trinity Street, and they leave on their outings from stands A, B and C at Pool Meadow, where the National Express pick up from too. Well, thank you, Elizabeth, and for all your nice and helpful comments this week. Please, let's hear from you next time. There's lots of ways you can contact us, send a message on that phone number, Phone Resource Centre on 02476 717 522, and press 5 for Coventry Talking Newspaper. Oh, write a letter either written by you or someone on your behalf, etc. Okay, thank you very much and bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
Last week, Elaine was at Napton on the Hill, but there's more to Napton, and Elaine is going to recount some wartime memories from that village.
Two friends of mine were not exactly evacuated, but moved out to Napton on the Hill during the war. And they both say that the school, during those years, was mixed. It was not a separate boys and girls. And they should know because they were there. When they were 9 years old, my friend Myra went to live in a cottage just outside Napton. It came about because her father was the manager of Cornercroft Engineering in Queen's Road in Coventry. And when the war was starting, it was decided that they would move the factory out of Coventry because there was a very high risk of it being damaged with bombs. One of the owners was Mr. Corner. The other was a Mr. Rycroft. Mr. Corner had a cottage in Napton as well as a house, and Myra's father and mother and Myra were offered the use of the cottage. Myra's father moved the factory out to Napton and rebuilt it on the, well, reused the brickworks that were empty at the time, and she went to Napton School for several years. Their house was in Lythall's Lane, and it did suffer some bomb damage, and so that was very well timed for them. But when their house was repaired, they went back to live there. My other friend Mary, her father was a pork butcher. He owned Palmer's, the pork butchers in town. One of his customers was the vicar of Napton, the Reverend Alwyn. The Reverend Alwyn and his wife came in on a Friday to do their shopping at Palmer's. And one day, Mrs. Alwyn said to Mr. Palmer, "Do you sell eggs?" And he said, "Oh, yes." And she said, "Would you like some from my chickens?" And he said, "Oh, yes, that would be very good. Thank you." And so every week, the Reverend Alwyn and Mrs. Alwyn took in eggs from their chickens in Napton. They lived in a 10-bedroom vicarage, and they became very friendly, the butcher and the vicar. And they used to, Mr. Palmer and the family used to go out on a Thursday afternoon, which was half day closing, to visit the Napton vicarage. And so when the war was coming, the Reverend Alwyn said to Mr. Palmer, "Should the need arise, you are very welcome to come and stay at the vicarage. We've got plenty of rooms." They lived, Mr. Palmer, in Earlston Avenue South, and the roof of their bungalow was damaged and had to be covered with a tarpaulin, and so the family went out to accept the hospitality of the vicar at Napton. Mary also went to the village school. There were three children from Coventry there. Neither Myra nor Mary can remember who the other girl was, but they do remember that the headmaster was called Mr. Payne, and he had a daughter called Olive. And there was a family who were farmed next door to the vicarage by the name of Green, and that family used to take Mary out into the countryside during the holidays and after school, and she learned a lot about nature, because being a city girl, so much of it was new. But they both, Mary and Myra, had very happy memories of their time spent out in Napton on the hill.
And next time, Elaine starts visits to three different Newbolds: Newbold on Stour, Newbold Pacey, but starting next week with Newbold on Avon. France has always had a reputation for its variety of cheeses, but British cheeses have come a long way, with some famous ones like Stilton and Wensleydale, and now lots of small artisan ones. But many of the established British cheesemakers have been absorbed by bigger concerns. In this first of a two-part article, Margaret reads about a cheesemonger's tour of France, written by Ned Palmer in the Daily Express.
Having championed the British cheesemaking renaissance, Ned Palmer's next stop was France. But Calorreur, the nation once deemed ungovernable because of its sheer number of varieties, is hooked on mass-produced Swiss factory cheese and trailing in our wake. Think France and you think cheese. Plump Camembert, heroic wheels of golden-hued Comté, lush slices of Brie, pecan rounds of Roquefort, and a myriad of more obscure treasures, from the pretty little goat's cheeses of Provence to the mighty Salers from volcanic Auvergne. All the different terroirs contained in France, from the wide fields of the Brie Plateau to the sunburnt rocky slopes of Provence, from the snow-covered Alps to the lush pastures of the Val de Loire, produce a bewildering variety of cheeses, each with their own traditions. France is a bastion of cheese-making craft, and those traditions have been handed down from generation to generation over centuries. Their produce then bought in family-run fromagerie by cheese fanatics who prize their pungent patrimony. but is this image a little rosy-hued? Perhaps with the heft of their reputation, the French have got a little complacent and forgot to future-proof their cheese industry. The most consumed cheese in France is now Emmental from Switzerland. Across the nation, Charles de Gaulle once joked was ungovernable due to its 246 variety of cheeses, a vast underestimate. The biggest sellers are made in factories from pasteurized milk and bought in supermarkets. Indeed, some of France's best-loved cheeses, jewels of its gastronomic cultural heritage, are under threat of extinction. Quelle horreur! This might seem like a familiar scenario to historians of British cheese culture. Our national cheese industry was decimated by the Industrial Revolution, the World Wars, and the rise of supermarkets. So by the 1970s, there were few traditional styles left. Most cheeses were made in factories and were pallid, uninteresting versions of their true selves. Happily, though, in the UK, this set the scene for the great British cheese renaissance. Beginning in the early 1980s, there was a flowering of small-scale cheese-making in Britain. Cheesemongers like Neil's Yard Dairy and the Fine Cheese Company began scouring the country for the remaining farmhouse cheeses, bringing them to avid consumers in the cities, while some city dwellers quit their jobs and occasionally, inspired by the TV sitcom The Good Life, bought small holdings and began making creamery or artisan-style cheeses with locally bought milk. Most of these new producers looked to the continent, particularly France, for their inspiration. As a result, we can now enjoy Loire-style goat's cheeses like Brightwell Ash, Roquefort-inspired Beanley Blue and Tunworth, which was described by Raymond Blanc as the best camembert in the world. Inspired by tradition but not bound by it, cheesemakers then went on to develop entirely new styles like Lincolnshire Poacher, a sort of hybrid of Cheddar and Gruyere, and Renegade Monk, a wild-tasting mix of washed rind and blue. Though I would like to see traditional cheesemaking on a firmer footing than it is in Britain in the last 10 years or so, the British cheese renaissance has taken a new turn. One I like to call the rise of the territorials, as British cheesemakers celebrate traditional styles. Stilton is being made to a standard which justifies its reputation as the queen of cheeses, and there is even a raw milk version, Stilton. Cloth-bound West Country Cheddar graces the shelves of many delis, and a huge range of traditional varieties are flourishing. In 2005, the Clark family began making Spark and Her Red Leicester on their farm in Leicestershire. There are now several producers of pre-war farmhouse style Wensleydale, a creamier, more complex cheese than the firm sandwich cheese beloved of Wallace and Gromit. Somerset Cheddar has also stepped further from the brink. Recently, Welsh cheesemakers, the Trethewans, quit Sleepy Llandywy Brefi for the bright lights of Western Supermare, where they make their traditional Caerphilly and Pitchfork, the first new Somerset farmhouse cheddar for 150 years.
And next week we'll be looking at more at British cheeses. Don't we all love the birds' dawn chorus so loud and cheerful in spring, and then watching while so many species descend on our nut feeders and bird baths? In this article taken from People's Friend, read by Elaine, Gillian Harvey meets Tracy Halls, who has quite a thing about birds.
When Tracy Hall's daughter Sasha came home from school early in 2017 and told her mother she'd seen a duckling in trouble, she had no idea that this day would turn out to be life-changing. We went back to see if it was okay. It was a tiny thing, shivering and on its own in someone's garden. I took it home and we spent ages warming it up. I even carried it in my top, close to my skin. We put it in the bathroom overnight and I feared the worst. But next day, it was running around, healthy as can be, says Tracy. This wasn't the first time Tracy had rescued a bird. I have quite a thing for birds, she says. When I was 8, we rescued a black-headed gull, and I used to sometimes have it in the bath with me. Having heard of the miraculous duck rescue, locals began to bring Tracy injured birds. Within a year, she had become known for rescuing everything from ducklings and geese to seagulls and pigeons, housing them in the garden of her home, which she shares with her husband and children. It was getting time-consuming and expensive, Tracy says, so I registered as a not-for-profit organisation, which means I can receive donations and raise funds. Tracy currently has over 65 avian residents staying in her specially purchased hutches and aviaries, some of whom are long-term and others she hopes to release into the wild. I always aim to release birds whenever possible, she says. One or two are here to stay. There's a pigeon that got hit by a car and can no longer fly, and a duck that has a severely damaged leg after a break that healed before she was brought in. Formerly a car mechanic, Tracy was forced to give up her work after developing ankylosing spondylitis, a type of arthritis, in 2016. However, running the sanctuary can be quite a physical challenge. I'm often up at the crack of dawn, feeding the birds, giving any medication, and dealing with any calls that have come in. By the afternoon, I'm back doing it all again. But I'm grateful to have the sanctuary as it gives me the push I need not to lay around and wallow, because the birds need me, Tracy says. Whether it's nursing fledglings fallen from their nest, bandaging broken wings, catching and fleeing birds trapped in plastic bottle rings, or dispensing advice to people who've noticed injured birds, Tracy is always on the go. Not everyone would be happy to have their spouse fill the house and garden with avian life, or get used to seeing ducks enjoying a dip in their tub, but Tracy's husband Jeff has learned to cope with the mayhem that comes with living at Quack House. When I first started, he used to come in sometimes, see a new resident and say, "Oh, what now?" But now he accepts that the birds have become part of our lives. He'll help out too, for example, if I need something to be built or I have to pick something up. My son also pitches in, as do my daughters. I really couldn't manage without them. While the all-consuming nature of caring for sick animals is challenging for Tracy, the biggest challenge is emotional. It's heartbreaking at times because you can't save everything, and the ones that don't recover take a piece of your heart with them. But it's a wonderful feeling too when you release a creature into the wild and realise that without your care, it wouldn't be alive. And Tracy occasionally gets a friendly return visit from an old patient. "I ring the ducks I help with a purple ring," she says, "and it's amazing when I come across them in the wild. The most memorable time was when a duck I'd helped returned with her ducklings. I came into the kitchen and found her waiting with them by the food." Over the 8 years since that first duckling, Tracy has learnt a lot about animal care, both through experience and through a series of online courses. "I've studied and taken exams in a variety of topics related to animal care and running a sanctuary. That said, nothing really beats experience when it comes to learning how to deal with various situations." The refuge is largely self-funded, although Tracy does receive donations of money or items at times. She raises money by running tombolas and raffles at local events. As for the future, there are always more wild animals to help. Tracy feels Quack House has reached its capacity. "I don't have any plans to expand," she says. "I just keep focused on being able to carry on as we are. To expand, I'd need land and a centre, so it'll have to wait until I win the lottery. But I'm quite happy with how things are now. I have the aviaries and accommodation I need, and really feel I'm making a difference.
And you can still hear a few bird songs at this time of the year, especially, of course, the noisy robin. Bill started his full steam ahead steam railway article last week, and now concludes it by recounting the railway's small army of volunteers who were taken to Tanfield as children and now keep the railway alive. This article was written by Karen Rocket in the Daily Express.
Tom, who works full-time as an instructor teaching new drivers on the Tyne and Wear Metro, admits it isn't always easy to find time for his passion. We've all got lives. I probably spend about a day and a half a week volunteering at Tanfield, but there is life beyond trains, although don't quote me on that. Sophie Martin, 30, is another volunteer of Tom's age, who, like him, fell in love with steam as a child. She has qualified as a fireman, but as the only female in such a role at Tanfield, she would love to see more women involved. "I think the fireman is the most fun job you can have operating a steam train," she says. "You are responsible for two things, fire and water. I think people misconceive it as putting out fires, but it's the exact opposite. You are making them." Sophie's dad was an electrical engineer who built a model railway in the Midlands, so she grew up around engines. But it was a visit to the National Railway Museum in York, aged 8, and standing on the footplate of the Mallard that inspired her to want to become a fireman. "I was handed a shovel, and I knew from that moment what I wanted to do," she beams. "I'm currently the only female fireman up here, and I recognised as a teenager it wasn't the standard thing for girls to like trains, and I took a step back from it. But now I have completely re-embraced it, and I am proud to say I love steam trains, and I would absolutely love for more females to get involved." Sophie celebrated her 30th birthday with a tea party in a carriage with her railway family. A manager for Amazon and an army reservist too, she still manages to find time for Tanfield. It helps that her husband-to-be, David Allinson, is a volunteer train driver and inspector on the railway, sharing her passion for steam. "It's a male-dominated world, but I have achieved what I have here on my own merit, and I would urge other girls interested in trains to do the same," she says. "You don't have to come from a railway background or to be a man to enjoy steam trains," Tom adds. "Not all heritage railwaymen have so many young volunteers or women as we do at Tanfield, and I think it's pretty special for us. We want different kinds of people from all walks of life to volunteer on these railways. It's nice to see different people enjoying steam trains, not just the stereotypical train enthusiasts like me." Some 170 people volunteer at Tanfield, and there are also 3 full-time members of staff, including General Manager David Watchman. He has been responsible for coordinating a number of events for Tanfield's 300th anniversary year, which are essential for raising funds towards the £500,000 minimum needed each year to keep it going. "I'm really proud of our railway. We have a fantastic bunch of volunteers," he says. "Everyone has their own skill set. It's all about the people, and we have volunteers aged 12 through to 92. The railway wouldn't exist without them. In the past 50 years, we have restored 3 miles of tract, restored numerous engines and carriages, built stations and all the infrastructure. So much has been achieved. I have been around railways since the age of 7. I've grown up with them, and I've made lots of memories, made lots of friends, and learned lots of new skills. It's the place I call home, really. David's father, Colin, was a volunteer guard at the railway, but in 2021 he suffered a fatal heart attack at the East Tanfield station, the railway's southern terminus. For a while, David found it difficult to be at the railway, but says he is creating new memories at Tanfield with his son Rory, 3, born after Colin died. Rory didn't really have any choice when it came to liking trains, but like so many of the volunteers here, he is growing up with them. He recognises the different engines now, and basically likes anything that moves and makes a noise. Like Tom and David and Sophie, it looks like trains may end up being Rory's story too. It's the sights, the sounds, the smells, and what your parents take you to when you're younger, Tom enthuses. It could have been classic cars, I suppose, but I am called Thomas, so it was meant to be.
I still think of steam trains as the only real trains. What are your thoughts and memories? Let us know in Postbag. And now some more thoughts on the origin of words and phrases by Susie Dent in the Radio Times, read by Margaret.
Dictionary Corner by Susie Dent. Chuggy pig. There are some 40 species of woodlouse common to the British Isles, yet most of us apply just one name to the creature, the one we learned as a child. Across British dialect, we are extremely spoiled for choice. In Cornwall, the insect is known as a grammar sow, part of a curious theme that likens woodlice to pigs, and then adds a grandparent to the mix. Perhaps the reference is an affectionate dig at the elderly, who might keep a woodlouse as a pet pig because they're too frail to look after the real thing. The theme continues through Dorset and Somerset, further north to Gloucestershire, where you might encounter a chuggy pig or a chucky pig. In Bristol, you could pick up a slunker pig, while in Wales, mochy coed, which gives you a tree pig. In the South East, there's a dairy theme with cheese rocker or cheese log. Next to all of these, the simple woodlouse feels rather tame.
Librocubicularist. Book readers come in many varieties, from those who casually borrow the latest novel from a friend and forget to give it back, the biblioclept, to those who are drunk on books at the expense of human conversation, the bibliobull. The Japanese sundoku exists for anyone who loves buying books and adding them to the unread pile in the knowledge they may never get to them all. They may have been seduced by the scent that is velicor, a term by writer John Koenig for the smell of old books and bookshops. Far better to enjoy this scent than a bibliophobia, the fear of being bookless. Of all reading types, most of us can relate to the librocubicularist. This mouthful describes something very familiar, being made up of the Latin liber, book, and cubiculum, bedroom. In other words, it is someone who reads in bed. Skullduggery. There is something menacing about the word skullduggery. Many of us would split it into skull and dug and assume a macabre link with the robbing of graves. Yet the spelling of the word has one L, and its origins have no connection to either skulls or digging. The term first appeared in print as skullduggery in the 1860s, when it referred to fraud or financial machinations. Its first appearances were in US English,
but it's based on a Scots word, skullduddery, which means fornication, unchastity, and generally lewd behaviour. Its origins are a little mysterious, but its second element may be based on dud, which in the Scottish church was the sackcloth of repentance. Today, folk etymology has given it a dark twist, a shorthand for covert behaviour, especially in a shady criminal underworld, which, given our wish to involve skulls, seems only fitting.
Are you a fan of the husky voice of Rod Stewart? Dave and Graham certainly are, as they recently went to Warner's Alverstone Hall in Cheshire to listen to a Simply Rod Stewart tribute concert.
Hello there, Graham and I are at Warner's Holiday Resort, and it's Alverstone Hall. And so what do you plan to do here, Graham?
Going to see a Rod Stewart tribute act and going to explore some of the activities and see what's going on.
Great, fantastic. Hello. Hi. I'm walking around the grounds of Alverstone Hall in this beautiful sort of nature walk now, and I'm speaking to Margaret at the moment. So do you like coming to Warner's?
We do. Yes, what we've do been like? Coming now for about 3 or 4 years. Yeah. We've done several now in Wales, the Isle of Wight, Hayling Island, on the borders of Wales. That was a very nice one. That was Holme Lacey, which we really enjoyed. We took a widowed friend of ours who recently lost her husband, so nice for her to come out and have a little holiday with us. So, but mostly there's the four of us. We come from West Sussex, Worthing Way. So,
excellent.
Yeah, we really enjoy it. Yes.
Okay. Do you take part in the activities here?
Some, yes. We've done the Keep Fit. We're thinking of doing the line dancing. Haven't quite got that far.
Oh yes, we're
the quizzes that we've done, but we actually bring our own card games, and we play a lot of cards, the four of us.
Yes.
Different puzzles. My the husband of my friend, he does a lot of puzzle books, so we have a go at doing his maths puzzles as well. So yeah, we really enjoy it. It's a good holiday.
It is, and Warner's is known for its entertainment
in
the evening.
Yes, we like the entertainment. Well, that's really how we pick each venue by what the entertainment is, and I think it's a Rod Stewart sound alike tonight, which is one of my favourites.
My
name is Margaret, so Maggie May is a very good record for me.
Good, excellent. Thank you for speaking to us, Margaret. Smashing. What a lovely day as well. Thank you. I then spoke to the groundsman, who is responsible for converting a golf course into a lovely nature walk.
Basically, when we came out of lockdown, there was no sign of them reintroducing the golf membership. So I just turned around and said, well, I'm going to make it into a nature walk for the guests, because the biggest complaint that the grounds team ever had was the guests had nowhere to walk.
Yeah, that's right.
So I gave them somewhere relatively safe to walk in natural surroundings, and being in nature, getting yourself close to nature, has been proven, medically proven, to be very good for your mental health.
Excellent.
And that is the reason why I did it.
Yes. So what kind of plants and wildlife have you seen?
So basically, we've got over 60 species of birds that use the site. We have had some. We've got a pair of hobbies that are our only migratory falcon. They come every year to the same area, but not necessarily the same nest. And we've got over 20 species of butterflies, which have been confirmed by the Butterfly Conservation Trust.
Excellent.
We've got at least 7 species of damselflies, dragonflies and damoiselles on the ponds. Frogs, toads, great crested newts, palmate newts and grass snakes on the ponds. And numerous insects. We've got, I think there's 7 different varieties of bumblebee alone that use the meadows.
Now, the one thing you've found is it's a plant. What do they call self-heal or something?
Self-heal, yeah. That is a very ancient herbal medicinal plant that when you ingest it, it helps your body sort of heal itself from the inside out. That's why it's called self-heal.
So there's plenty to keep you happy at Warner's leisure centres. And if you haven't got transport to get to these places, well, Dunwoods go there. And their holidays include two outings. And they're based on Trinity Street. In the main room, the Grove, hundreds of tables and chairs were set out for people to have a meal and then enjoy the show. I went backstage and afterwards I talked to one of the performers and organisers, Lindsay. Lindsay, we're standing on the stage of Warner's Theatre and it's fantastic. We've just been behind the scenes. Can you point out some sort of highlights of our tour, please?
Yeah, sure. So the main purpose of having the backstage tour is just to give the guests the experience of what it's like for us working on an entertainment team here at Warner's. We're called the Warner Theatre Company. So we put on three team shows a week here and we all sing, we all dance and we all do daytime activities as well. There's a lot of technical things that we've gone through today on our backstage tour that makes me feel really knowledgeable about things like that. But yeah, we take on people that love to perform. And that is a massive part of the role here. Yeah, and we absolutely love it, and we get to meet lots of different guests every week. It's nice that people take an interest in what we do, and I know lots of people enjoy doing things as a hobby, like in their spare time. And that is how I got started in this industry, is just doing the local panto, the local community drama group, and then it just escalated from there, and now I get to perform and get paid for it. So.
Well, one thing you mentioned intrigued me. You actually paint Coca-Cola on the stage. And what's that for?
Yeah, so our technician, because our stage is made of wood, our technician coats it in Coca-Cola every so often, just so that we don't slip over in our slippery dance shoes, which we do have pads that go underneath to keep us, but we are doing a lot of spinning around and stuff, so the Coca-Cola just coats it so that it's a little bit sticky, so we don't go head over heels on the stage. No one wants to fall over in front of 400
people.
Don't,
do they? No.
But it has happened.
Yeah, great.
And it is difficult to carry on performing when you're laughing so much as someone else fall over. So,
Excellent. So, what's the most, famous person you've had performing here?
Oh, see, the most famous. I think Michael Ball is probably one of the most famous. We've also had Alfie Bowe, Tony Hadley, Jane MacDonald. We've got Beverly Knight here soon.
She is nice.
Yeah,
she
seems really nice. I've not met her before.
She is lovely.
It's great when we get the famous acts come in. We just don't get to hang out with them like we would with any of the other acts. But yeah, they've all been brilliant and no divas.
We're now going to hear from Simply Rod Stewart. Now, you've come a long way tonight, haven't you?
Yes.
You come from Scotland?
All the way from Glasgow.
Well, Glasgow, that's a fair distance.
Yeah, I think it was about 4.5 hours, maybe 5 hours. So, yeah.
So was it worth it to come to Warner's?
Yeah, I love Warner's. I do Warner's all the time. I've got a gig tonight here at Alveston. Tomorrow night I'm in a place called Bodwellan Castle in Wales.
Yeah, I'm going there.
So I do about 25 shows a year for Warner's all down south. It's fantastic. I love it. It's great.
Now you've got the okay from Rod Stewart. You met him, didn't you?
Yeah.
So how did that go?
He thought my show was brilliant.
Thanks for a great holiday at Warner's, Graham. And it's cheerio from me. And it's cheerio from Graham.
Bye.
And now with the songs of Rod Stewart still ringing in our ears, we come to the end of this week's Outlook.
So till next week, it's goodbye from me, Nigel Hewin, and all the Outlook team.